Hi, I'm Dan, and I'm working from home in the South Loop, and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much, Dan. Working from home, that is still a thing. Good morning. Welcome to Outside the Loop. This is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. This is show number 788. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. You can always say hello to us online at Outside the Loop on Twitter. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, websites. It's all for you. OutsideTheLoopRadio.com is the website, as well as WGNRadio.com for the audio archives. And subscribe to the podcast of the show if you don't do so already. It is free, gets delivered to your device each week. And it's lots of fun, that podcast. We live in the future now. We have a great show for you today. We will be taking a look at the history of Uptown from a different perspective. Two UIC professors put together a project to tell the people's history of Uptown, and we will learn all about that project. Also, our good pal Steve Krakow, the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music, joins us once again. This week, we learn about a 1980s alternative rock band, kind of in the vein of the Smashing Pumpkins, called Stark. And they didn't last too long. They didn't record much, but we've got the whole story on the show today. Speaking of friends of the show, John Greenfield joins us on occasion. He is the editor of Streets Blog Chicago. He's also a columnist for the Chicago Reader. And recently he wrote this piece on Streets Blog Chicago, the story of him. He was riding his bike and he wanted Portillo's. And he had actually, you know, he's lived in Chicago for a long time. According to this, he's never had Portillo's. So he's got to have that experience. So he rode his bike, as he's prone to do. He rode his bike to the Portillo's in Avondale, and apparently he couldn't get inside because the inside was closed. So he was on his bike, so he got in the drive-thru line, and the employees at Portillo's said that he couldn't go through the drive-thru on his bicycle. They said it was for his own safety, and look, I understand when you've got cars that are hungry for Portillo's, the people driving those cars starving for Portillo's, things might happen. And if you're on a bike and you go up against a car, you're going to lose that battle 100% of the time. I get that. But I don't know, you know, if you're Portillo's, maybe try to open up the drive-through line to make it more bicycle friendly. Because think of the business, especially in the summertime, that you could drum up. And I know that restaurants outside of Chicagoland have done this, have specifically made bike-friendly drive-through lanes in the drive-through of these restaurants, which I think is kind of a fun idea. I don't know. I think this could be something where you get more business, more people get the product, you take your bicycle, you get that beef or whatever it is that you're ordering, you pull over to the side because that is going to be a hefty meal, you eat that sucker, you get back on the bicycle, and then you feel good about yourself because you're burning off the calories that you just ingested. Just saying that I think this could be something maybe we should look into. Also, apparently, Superdog, they tweeted that they're cool with that. They have got like those, you know, little stations that you can pull into. Apparently, Superdog, you can ride your bicycle and get those hot dogs. So there it is. All right, well, get your bicycle ready. Get up to that drive-through. We will be feeding you some delicious audio today. Stay tuned. The stories of communities and neighborhoods is essential to understanding Chicago. Two UIC professors have created a project that explores a people's history of the Uptown neighborhood through the collaborative public history project called Displacements. Gayatri Reddy is an associate professor of gender and women's studies and anthropology at UIC, and Anna Guevara is an associate professor of global Asian studies at UIC and is the director of that program. The website for this project is dis-placements.com, and it's a really fascinating website. And Gayatri and Anna are here with us today on Outside the Loop. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
Likewise. Thanks so much, Mike.
Oh, well, it's great to have you here. So let's talk about, first of all, displacements. This is a public history digital project. That's a fancy title. What exactly does that mean?
So this project basically highlights stories about Uptown, and we do that in different formats. And so one of them is a political walking tour where you can basically take a tour of Uptown focused on particular themes, and you can do a self-guided tour. You just need your cell phone to do that, mm-hmm. or be on, you know, facing your computer. So that's one aspect of the project. Another is that we have partnered with students and community partners to produce digital stories. So these are mini documentaries based on the work of students with particular oral history narrators. And so for a semester project, they each work with a narrator who is either a resident or an organizer in Uptown, and then produce a mini documentary that we have featured on the website. And then we also have various multimedia projects that either students or also collaborators have worked on. So it's basically a portal that hopefully allows us to give people a glimpse of Uptown through their fingertips. And hopefully after, you know, once we're out of this pandemic, they will also be able to visit Uptown, but will have some sense of some of the stories that really give life and meaning to this neighborhood.
So why Uptown? I mean, Uptown's a great neighborhood today, and I think it does have a lot of great history, but what made you say Uptown is something that we need to really dive into and tell the story?
Yeah, maybe I can start, and I'm sure Gayatri can also add to it, but I think Uptown has had a long history of being a port of entry for various migrants. And so it was really interesting for us to kind of learn that, you know, there are, you know, various migrant populations, for example, the white Appalachians who came from the South following the closure of the mines, the, you know, great migration that drove African Americans fleeing Jim Crow South to look for jobs. And then there were also Japanese Americans who, after the closure of the camps in California in particular, started to also look to other urban centers like Chicago. And, you know, of course, Native Americans who were displaced and forcibly displaced from the reservations to various urban centers like Chicago. I mean, all of these, you know, migrant populations or communities kind of converged in Uptown, where there was, you know, affordable housing, where there were jobs. So it was interesting to see the ways in which, you know, that convergence took place. And also in the midst of various urban renewal policies that also led to, you know, kind of threatened that affordable housing. And one of the things that we learned and really, you know, got us interested in Uptown is that even in the midst of all the, you know, all these urban renewal policies, I mean, these same communities, you know, fought back, and they built very strong coalitions with one another. I mean, cross-racial, cross-class coalitions to fight against these policies. And so part of the, you know, our devotion to the project is driven by wanting to tell this story of not just the struggle, but also the resistance. And what, you know, some of our, actually one of the community historians, Paul Siegel, would refer to as submerged histories of resistance.
Yeah, the only thing I would add to that is in many ways, Uptown is both exemplifies sort of the history of segregation of Chicago neighborhoods, but also, as Anna pointed out, was unique because unlike communities, neighborhoods that were segregated on the basis of race, these various communities were thrown together. And so sort of intentionally or unintentionally, they were thrown together. And so they began to forge these solidarities and these movements that crossed these racial boundaries.
You know, in terms of the research for this, the website again is dis-placements.com. And really, there is so much information on this site. It is really incredible. And I know that you said that you've partnered with some students, and some students have worked at UIC on this project. But how did you go about researching this? Because you have tons of videos and articles and library archives. What was this research process like?
Long and tortured.
Yep.
But yeah, so it involved, you know, looking at the Peggy Terry archives, which chronicle some of the histories of JOIN and SDS and other kinds of organizations that were central to the stories of Uptown and its resistance in the 60s. But it also involved sort of basically doing a deep dive in people's basements where they had collected a lot of these community newsletters over the years, and engaging for multiple years. We started the project in 2017. Even though it got started, I guess, essentially 2018. But for these last few years, it's kind of wonderfully taken over our lives. And so we've been engaging in conversations with a lot of the long-term activists in these neighborhoods. And that's really enriched our learning, our understanding, and our access to a lot of these archives that haven't really been chronicled or saved anywhere.
You know, looking at Uptown today, I guess, you know, here we understand Uptown. There are, you know, great restaurants and great things going on in Uptown, but it's a fairly diverse community as well, which is wonderful. But looking at it today from when it got started, are there similarities? Are there differences that sort of, you know, pop up throughout the history of Uptown as we look at it today versus from when it started?
Yeah, that's a really important question. I think one of the things that we are very concerned with right now is the ongoing gentrification or escalating gentrification of the neighborhood. And I mean, we saw, the urban renewal policies take seed, in the 20s, but that, you know, unfortunately is blossoming in other ways that is threatening the rate of affordable housing in Uptown and the ability to kind of retain the diverse demographics that Uptown is known for, not only along racial but also class lines. And so I think much of what Uptown is facing right now is, again, trying to resurrect this submerged histories of resistance or trying to rekindle that to, again, organize against developers who are, building luxury apartments. And one of the things that we're very much involved with right now and a lot of our community partners are fighting for is holding on to Weiss Hospital, which is unfortunately under threat because, the parking lot, which it rests on, has been purchased by a pipeline company, which is a hedge fund company. And that company has sold it to Lincoln Property to be developed and rezoned into a luxury housing that only contains 8 out of 314 units. So only eight are affordable out of 314 units. And Uptown needs affordable housing. And unfortunately, this is just one example of the decline in affordable housing in the neighborhood. So I think that is one important change one red flag that the neighborhood is facing right now.
Mm. You know, a sub project that is part of Displacements is the Winthrop Family Project, an important story to tell. And it tells the story of racial segregation on the north side of Chicago. Again, we might not think of racial segregation on the north side, but this was happening, in many places during the time, especially of redlining and in the 20th century. in Uptown, focusing on one block here, the 4600 block of Winthrop Avenue, what was this block? How did this happen? What is the story here?
Yeah, no, thanks for that question and for highlighting this project. It's been our honor and pleasure to work with the descendants of the original families who were segregated to this one block, as you said, of Winthrop Avenue. So this project is the story of, as you said, African-Americans on the north side of Chicago, on the one block that they were restricted to living in, on in Uptown, the 4600 block of Winthrop. And so in some ways, this came about because, I mean, I guess there's several threads to the story. One is that there was, as we all know, a large migration of African-Americans from Jim Crow South as part of the various waves of the Great Migration. And thanks in part to some of the congestion in the Black Belt area of the South, as well as sort of opportunities for jobs on the North side, there were families that migrated from Tennessee, from Mississippi, et cetera, to the North side as well. And so, as you rightly pointed out, we presume that, you know, the South side neighborhoods kind of contain all histories and stories of segregation. But in fact, the North side has a sort of a thriving community of African-Americans as well. So in the 20s is when Uptown began to kind of boom, as you, if you will, in terms of a revitalization of the arts and commerce district. So this was when the Uptown Theater was built. This was when SNA Studios was built. This was when Gold Black Department Store was built. And this was also when the train lines were extended to the north side. And there was a new station that was built at Wilson Avenue. And so this kind of created a boom of this neighborhood, which both required a laboring class to service it, but at the same time, it also, among the corporate white elite, it raised all of these red flags where they didn't want a what they referred to as a colored invasion of their neighborhood. And so they created all of these organizations, and one of them was the Chicago Uptown Association, which intentionally worked to keep African-Americans restricted or out of this neighborhood if possible, but otherwise restricted to living on just this one block of the 4600 block of Winthrop Avenue. And so this project tells the story of the residents of that block from at least the 1920s is when we know that there were at least 18 families and several individual lodgers who were living on the Winthrop Avenue block. And it tells the story of the descendants of these families and their memories of this block, but also capturing those histories of race restrictive covenants, of these petitions that sort of caused them to live on just this one block. So that's one story. And the other story is it kind of flips the narrative of segregation on its head a little bit, because it not only captures these stories on the north side, as we just talked about, but it also, while it doesn't deny the sordid saga of segregation and racism, it also, all of the stories from the Winthrop Avenue family members who we've been interviewing for the last 2 years or so, all of them emphasize the tight-knit relationships that they had with each other, the sort of bonds of love and community and care that they created. And so in some ways, while it doesn't deny segregation and racism, it also emphasizes joy, it emphasizes everyday little pleasures, it emphasizes community building and sort of creating communities of care on the north side.
And you have some audio of people that were directly impacted, descendants of those folks who were living there. And you know, some folks that you interview And the audio is on your website, dis-placements.com. You have audio of people who lived there maybe when they were kids, but you hear that firsthand account of what it was like living on the 4600 block of Winthrop and Uptown.
When I tell you the 4600 was home and family, anything beyond that border, you almost felt like you were trespassing. But once you got over there, you felt like you were in your own world. This is my world right here. I don't think we thought about the prejudice as you see it now. And yet it was there. It was just kind of incognito, you know.
Yeah, and it has been really fascinating for us to hear the family members kind of, you know, not just tell us that story, but tell each other those stories and for them to remember collectively what life was like. I mean, remembering kind of, you know, for example, Mama Sophie was one of the matriarchs and I believe the unofficial mayor of the Winthrop block. And many of the family members, you know, spoke so fondly of her, spoke so fondly about the, you know, her love for gardening that many of the family members still, you know, can kind of remember and really, you know, and when they talk, you can feel that kind of, you know, the textures in their stories and sort of, you know, and really gives you the picture of what that community was like. And yeah, there was something really kind of magical in many ways being a witness to them retelling that story and just, you know, painting a picture of what that community was like. And they were very young at that point, but their memories were, you know, really crisp and clear and gave you a sense of that life.
You know, I think it's interesting with this project that we're talking about here, this Winthrop Family Project, which is part of the larger Displacements Project. You know, when we talk about stories of segregation and race relations, you know, in the 20th century, as we look back on our history, I think it's really easy to center the conversation around those restrictions and the segregation and the redlining, which are, of course, really important. But as we're talking about, this project kind of turns the narrative upside down a little bit. And I think another thing that's really important is that you're centering empowerment, you're centering joy, you're centering love, and the fact that these are human beings, and that on Winthrop Avenue, it was a community, and we can't lose sight of that. And that, I think, is centered in the story, which I think humanizes the history.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that is one of the really important sort of takeaway lessons from this is, I mean, both, as Anna just said, sort of the pleasures of listening to these memories being recounted is precisely that. You can really feel that that humanity, that those relationships, that love, that caring that comes through in the many, many stories that they tell about their memories. And some of these individuals are in their 70s and 80s and were, you know, children on the block. And it's still to this day so vivid in their lives and what they, almost every single narrative and every single interview that we've done emphasizes precisely this, the love, the caring that they all always felt with every member, whether or not they were biological kin on this block. This was their Winthrop Avenue family, as they call them.
It's really powerful. And I think that this is, again, important when we think about the history of Chicago, how we talk about race relations in our history and how the evolution of the city has unfolded. And also, it's a really great human story that I think we should all tap into. And we can through the website for the Displacements Project. It's dis-placements.com, dis-placements.com. And on that website, you can find a ton of really fascinating history about Uptown and the Winthrop Family Project as well. And this project created by Gayatri Reddy, who is an associate professor of gender and women's studies and anthropology at UIC, and Anna Guevara, who is an associate professor of global Asian studies at UIC and the director of that program. Gayatri and Anna, thank you so much for talking to us today. All of your hard work. I know there was a lot that went into all this, so I think it's worthwhile. And thank you so much for chatting today.
Well, thank you so much, Mike. It's been a pleasure and an honor. And we really appreciate you uplifting this project, the Displacements Project in general, but especially the Winthrop Avenue Project as well.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Chicago Reader, you will see the column The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
Yes, dialing up across town, making that connection with Mr. Steve Krakow, who is in the lair of an apartment over there in the Ukrainian Village, just hanging out and jamming some tunes today from the band Stark, S-T-A-R-K. Stark, I've never heard of these guys before, but they're coming out of the 80s. And Steve, this is, I kind of dig it, some like alternative rock for us. And these musicians in Stark, as you open up the piece here, you say that they just barely make the cutoff here for you.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, people get in touch with me all the time and they're like, cover my old band or this old band I loved. And, you know, if it's from the 90s, to me, that's when I was going to a lot of shows, first going to shows pretty much as a youngster. So it doesn't seem old enough to me, even though I'm, like I said, I'm fooling myself because this is like 30 years ago or something now. But yeah, Stark started at the end of the 80s and then kind of ticked another box for me, too. They were mostly like a U of I and Urbana Champaign band. Though they gigged with a lot of Chicago bands, the lead fellow Matt that I talked to, he's from Chicago. Yeah. You know, so it scratched a little itch there as they were sort of like a few years before I got there. They pretty much broke up the year I got there. So I never really got to see them, and we sort of know, and they gigged with a lot of bands I saw down there and stuff too. So it was interesting in that regard.
Yeah, this is a band, again, they're called Stark. They're coming at us in the late 1980s here, and they have, you know, some maybe brushes with bands that will go on to fame and fortune, but you sort of begin the story here. You talk about how they were founded in Champaign-Urbana in 1988. They were kind of like this art rock band, and you talked to Matt Golosinski, I think I'm saying that right. And
I think so. As a Polish boy, I'm assuming a little Polish boy. I think that sounds correct. Yeah.
We'll go with that. He was born in 1965, grew up on the Northwest Side, Addison and Cumberland.
Yeah.
And so he is one of the founding members. How did this band get started?
Well, he got exposed to a lot of cool stuff in Chicago, needless to say. He was going to Wax Trax, and they got all kinds of cool imports and stuff there of, like, punk and industrial music. So, you know, started as a classic rocker into Cheap Trick and all that, and I thought it was funny. He said his parents thought their lyrics were objectionable until they kind of got into punk, and then they were like, oh, geez, no, this is objectionable, you know.
It's all relative.
It is. It really is. But yeah, you know, so bass playing guy went down to Champaign, you know, sort of armed with this music love and knowledge. And it just seemed like it was the good old organic days when you just met people, and, you know, at your school, and you were all in a bunch of bands, and then you started a cool band together. That classic story that doesn't really happen anymore. I don't know. Maybe.
No, I like that. That is kind of like the old school, you know, you start playing together and it feels good, and then you go on to the next stage, so to speak. So you say that you know, they start to listen to more maybe edgy music, some punk music, and they're developing their sound. So how does this band get going? Because they form the band, and I know that there's some other folks that come through the band, but they're playing around Urbana-Champaign.
Yeah, well, interesting enough, they have two ex-drummers from this band I loved that were still going strong and are still going today, Poster Children.
They're awesome.
Yeah, they're oh man, I saw them down in Champaign like a million times, and you know, by the time I got to them, they were kind of like elder statesmen of the scene. There were a hot moment where all these bands from Champaign were actually kind of being signed, and sadly Matt left, and he said sure enough there was a major label sniffing around, but you know, he had just kind of had enough of the band, which is, you know, I sensed, you know, I used a quote from him in the strip that he had some guilt. But, you know, honestly, of all the bands that got signed in that town, not too many of them went on to too much glory.
Yeah, that is
Hardvark,
true.
Hardvark, anyone? Honcho Overload? You heard of these bands?
Who?
No, oh, 16 Tons? No, you haven't heard of these? Okay, well, there's a reason. Yeah.
So, all right, you tell the story in the strip here of when there was this time where Stark, the band, opened up for Smashing Pumpkins in 1989, and there was a little bit
of major labels.
Right,
yes.
Right. And so everyone was starting out here. So you tell a story about an interaction with Billy Corgan, but do you have another story that did not make it into the strip?
Yeah, he told me a few stories. He, you know, he had one that I thought that I put in that was amazing, that, you know, more or less he convinced Billy Corgan to keep Darcy in the band. He was like, I need a bass player like you. Darcy's flubbing notes. And he's like, no, really, she's doing really good up there, and she looks a lot better than me, and you should just keep her. And he was like, okay, well, all right. You know, so that was kind of like you could just kind of see that plan out. Knowing the Corgan, as we all do. But yeah, there was another tale of them coming back to playing, and it was like a Tuesday night or something, and they were basically like, where are the sorority girl parties? And they're like, you know, on a Tuesday night, I don't think you're going to be getting into such a sorority
girl. So wait, the Pumpkins were asking for sorority girl parties.
They were asking for, like, they wanted to go out and maybe find some young ladies, and they thought, like, a sorority party was going to be the place. And they were like, well, you know, honestly, on a Tuesday, they're just going to be home studying. You're not really going to find any parties going on in the sororities. And they're like, no, really, where are they? And they were like, okay. And I know this, having gone to Champaign, the largest Greek system in the country. You can't get away from it down there. Frat boy mania. Sorority girl mania. So I guess they went and hit like a bunch of sorority girl houses, and show enough, nothing was happening. They sort of came back and were like, yeah, you were right. Wow, there's really nothing going on. And I think the sort of punchline zinger was, come back on a weekend.
Yeah, right.
Come play down here on a weekend. There'll be people at your show you might meet into music and stuff. And yeah, you could probably go cruise the sorority girls party scene afterwards if you really want. But I think he said something about Billy possibly having green hair at that time as well, too. But
Period.
Yeah, hey, you know, honestly, this is not me flossing anything. I would see Billy at shows in the early 90s, more of his vintage clothes, long, wispy hair phase. And none of us would have suspected he was going to lose it all. I would go up and talk to him. I'd be like, hey, when are you guys playing again? And he'd have like a fabulous like 70s fur coat. And then, yeah, something happened. He lost the hair. He went to the all black, like, you know, Lycra suits or whatever. And something happened to Billy down the line there.
Yeah. Well, all right. We've talked about him way too much. So
way too much for Billy.
Let's focus on Stark. So like you said, Matt Golosinski pretty much leaves the band, breaks things up, and that's pretty much it for Stark.
Yeah, you know, I mean, he said they kind of they went on a little bit without him. Somebody switched the bass and sort of took his spot, but it sounds like not for very long. And it, you know, like I said, he had a little regret about sort of killing the momentum of the band. But as someone also, I understand it, once you've done your 4 years in Champaign, sometimes I think it's good to get out of that place. It's a real small town, and people, I believe one of the hardest drinking towns in all of Illinois, like alcohol consumption rate. So it's, I feel like we'd roll into town and you go buy a case of beer, you know, like it's just like, it's a hard living town in some ways. And it sounds like everybody was maybe partying a little too much in the band, and he knew to sort of get out of there. And he went on to, he works at Northwestern now, and sounds like he's done some work curating with music exhibits and stuff there as well. So he seems like a happy guy. And it's cool, they found these tapes. Okay, so they never released anything. We should state this.
Right.
They cut a couple demos, never really got, maybe they were like given out at shows or whatever, but probably cassettes. And recently, this cool cat, Henry Frayne, who was in a very beloved Champagne band, Moon Seven Times, and then he has a solo project called Lanterna. There are these really cool sort of guitar instrumentals. Very beloved guy in Champagne and around. He had tapes. He had the original masters in his closet because he was a fan of the band. So he's a great audio guy. So had these in good shape and everything, so the dudes were able to get them, and now you can hear everything. It's on Bandcamp, it's on Stark's site, and again, cool band, you know, kind of straddled the line between like new wave, classic rock, pop, and sort of alternative rock, you know, like you say. I heard it all in there, and then when I talked to Matt, he told me they were into all those things, and I'm like, boom, there it is, you know.
Well, the band that we are profiling this week, the band Stark. You can find the entire story in the Chicago Reader and at chicagoreader.com, as well as a hand-drawn picture of that band by Steve Krakow, who is the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music and local musician, music historian. Steve, as always, thank you so much for talking to us today.
And remember, stay away from those sorority houses on Tuesday nights.
The same people I've known for years, trading lovers with them all. On the way to work, I still don't pass the
And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 788 is all wrapped up just for you. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for being our engineer today. And have a wonderful week and a fantastic Thanksgiving. I'm thankful for you. I'll talk to you again next time here on Outside the Loop on 720 WGN.